Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 261, The Silmarillion, A Tale of Two Endings. On this episode, we're joined by Keith Matheson to discuss his article, The Silmarillion, A Tale of Two Endings. Keith is a native of Texas, living in Central Florida now. He has been married for 31 years and has two grown children and one grandchild. He teaches at Reformation Bible College, where, as part of the school's Great Works of Literature program, he teaches a Great Works of Tolkien class every fall. Though once an avid surfer, he now spends much of his free time bombadilly-dallying around used bookstores. Keith, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Well, it's good to have you. It was really enjoyed our discussion last time. All right. Well, before we dive in, we'd like to give a double up air five to our patrons. Keith, if you want to join in, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. This is something new that we've been doing since last time. So we do our double up air five through the internet, through the camera, and I count it down. So if you want to double up air five, you're welcome to. If not, I'm cool with that too. All right, Keith's going to join in. Great. 3, 2, 1. Whoopsh. There we go. All right. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous. It's also time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 or Tolkien Road YouTube Air 5 for all of those watching us over on YouTube. All right, Keith, this is just one hand. All right, so you can join in with us again here. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. All right. You too can be a part of the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5. Just head on over to YouTube where this episode is posted and give your best whoops in the comments below. All right. So, Keith, like I said, this is your second time on the Tolkien Road. Back on episode 216, we discussed your article on Tom Bombadil, the Bombadil Enigma, and that was a really great article, great discussion, really enjoyed it. And today we're going to take a look at your article on another puzzling issue in Tolkien's Legendarium, the ending of the Silmarillion. So you told me about this article in response to my video from a few months back, three major problems with the Silmarillion and how to fix them. And I think you got an email about it that I sent out to my email list, and you responded and you were like, hey, John, there's a fourth, right? And I was like, oh. So I clicked through and read it and I was like, oh, this article's really good. So I thought, and this is something I'd heard other people allude to. Is something you should check out. There's actually a different ending of the Silmarillion. And so, and I was somewhat aware of it from having gone through our History of the Middle Earth survey earlier this year, but you really do a great job of explaining why there are these two endings in this article. And then you kind of go into why Christopher may have chosen one ending over the other. And then you argue for why really you think the other ending may have been a better and more fitting ending to the Silmarillion. So let's just start with, what do you mean by two endings to the Silmarillion? Hey there, fellow travelers. If you've made it this far on your journey down the Tolkien Road, you take Tolkien and Middle-earth as seriously as we do. That being the case, we want to invite you to join the Tolkien Road community over on Patreon. You've certainly heard us give shoutouts to our patrons before, but that's not the only benefit our patrons receive. Other benefits include patron-only episodes, annual gifts, personalized video greetings from John and Greta, early access to new episodes, free copies of my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, and more. Oh yeah, and just in case you find ads like this a bit annoying, Tolkien Road episodes are ad-free on Patreon. That's right. Not only do you get the latest episodes of the Tolkien Road early on Patreon, but you get them commercial-free as well. Most importantly, your monetary support makes it possible for the Tolkien Road to keep on evering on. The truth is, it takes time and money to create this podcast, and every dollar helps us on our quest to make the Tolkien Road something Tolkien himself would be proud of. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road for more info. Once again, that's patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Now back to the show.
Well, I really also feel like before I say a single word of criticism, I need to be 110% clear that I have nothing but the deepest respect for Christopher Tolkien, and I hesitate to even suggest challenges. I am stunned at the work he did, not only in producing the Silmarillion that we have, but in the work he put into the history of Middle Earth. So I don't want any listener or viewer to take anything I say as being, I don't consider it being critical of him. I consider it responding to something he invited readers to do after he published the history of Middle Earth. He said now it invites criticism of the construction. So he invited it, but I am so thankful for the work he did. We would not have nearly as much material from Tolkien if it wasn't for him. But what I mean by the two endings of the Silmarillion is, since the publication of the Silmarillion back in the 70s, that was the only ending anybody knew. And I mean, when I say the ending of the Silmarillion, I mean the ending of the Quinta Silmarillion. It's followed by the Vala Quinta.
So the stories of the First Age that are in the book, the Silmarillion. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And those, so it's not the last page of actual material in the Silmarillion, but it's the ending of the Quinta Silmarillion.
To be clear, you mean the end of chapter 24 in the Silmarillion.
Just before the Vala
Quinta. Right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Or Akalabeth. It's just before Akalabeth.
That's right. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Vala Quinta is on the mind and I know why. So yeah, but we're talking about the very end of chapter 24. Yeah.
Right. And yes, it's late here. I'm old. My brain is fading fast. But yes, and that ending was all anybody was aware of, except for a handful of people in Tolkien's immediate family and circle, until the publication of the 12 volumes, The History of Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. And as he produced those and we got to watch the development of these stories from the earliest versions on till the 1936 version, there's a fairly consistent ending. Even though The Lost Tales wasn't completed, there's the sketches we have there, and then the intermediate versions of the Silmarillion, and then that 1936 version, all have a similar ending that includes this thing called the Second Prophecy of Mandos, mm-hmm. which speaks of Arda healed, where basically you have the happy ending, the Eucatastrophe at the end of the story, and Melkor is finally defeated, Turin finally gets some payback, and it's consistent throughout all those early versions of the Silmarillion. Well, when Christopher put together the version in the 1970s and did all that work, he had to look at all of that, all of his father's later revisions and everything, and based on some criteria he set up for himself, he chose to leave that second prophecy out. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, it changes the tone of the story because of the ending. It's kind of like if a Christmas Carol ended and Scrooge woke up from the third ghost and he was still stingy. It changes changes the flavor of the story a little bit. And
sure.
So not many general readers are even aware that other one exists. Very few mm-hmm. people go back and read those, the whole 12 volume History of Middle Earth, but those who've read it and compared the last paragraphs, it's really striking the difference between those endings and how they affect the tone. And so I was just curious about this. And so I started reading and digging and digging on this. And because Christopher invited criticism and trying to figure out why did he leave this out of the published version. And, you know, I've found some reasons that I think are the main reasons he left that out. But then I found also a lot of reasons that in mm-hmm. my mind would indicate that perhaps his father intended for that to be there all along, even after he left it to Christopher to finish it up.
Well, and one thing I learned through my own survey of the history of Middle Earth and Unfinished Tales and reading a lot of Christopher's own commentary with those works, it's almost like Christopher, after he published the Silmarillion, you know, 4 years after the death of his father, he then was like, this, I think nothing could have done justice to what his father had written in his mind. And he just, and so it's almost like the rest of his life project was just going back and like packaging everything that was actually there for all of us and saying like, I really did my best in 1977, but I probably, and he was even, I mean, he was self-critical too. He was self-critical from Unfinished Tales all the way through to the end, and saying like, you know, maybe I should have done this differently. You know, I mean, and, you know, I can see now why maybe this wasn't the best choice to have done, you know, with the Silmarillion. So Christopher was his own, worst, best critic. I don't know what you want to call it, but he was self-critical, you know? And so he was, I think that's a mark of humility and of love for his father's work at the same time. And so that's part of his inviting the rest of us to make valid and good insightful criticisms as well.
I think so. I mean, he even used the word regret. See, he mm-hmm. said there are aspects of the work that I view with regret in War of the Jewels. And again, I do think, although all Tolkien fans owe him the deepest thanks, that does open the door. And I think as long as it's friendly criticism, understanding criticism, mm-hmm. and not, you know, arrogant,
right,
know-it-all kind of criticism, I think if good arguments can be set forward, that it's worth at least considering. The fact that Christopher didn't consider himself an infallible compiler or constructor.
Well, and at the end of the day, it's at the very least, this alternate ending exists, right? Tolkien wrote it at one point. And so it's good for us, even if we land at the opposite conclusion that Christopher included the correct one, it's good to understand at least what this other ending, possible ending, was, and why Tolkien might have chosen to do that, and why he might have rejected that. But you go the other way, and you argue that, hey, maybe this one's better. So, you know, so we've got, I think we kind of understand the ending of the published version of the Silmarillion is pretty straightforward, right? It's pretty short. You know, I'll go ahead and read it. I've got the Silmarillion here right in front of me.
Hey there, fellow Tolkienites. Since you happen to be listening to this podcast, I thought you'd be excited to hear that my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture are now available on Audible. Tolkien's Requiem is an exploration of the First Age story of Beren and Lúthien, as found in the Silmarillion. In Tolkien's Requiem, I explore how the story is rooted in Tolkien's own life, and the important role it plays in the Middle-earth legendarium. One reader called it a gift to the world, and another said, I wish I'd been able to read Tolkien's Requiem years ago. Tolkien's Overture explores Ainulindale, the music of the Ainur, which is the Middle-earth creation story. In Tolkien's Overture, I conduct a close reading of the text as found in the Silmarillion, and proceed to unpack the incredible role that music plays in the legends and lives of Middle-earth. One reader called it an excellent book, a critical and thoughtful deep dive into Ainulindale. Both books have been recently re-recorded in order to meet professional audiobook standards. Not only are both books available in audiobook format via Audible, but in signed paperback and Kindle as well. To learn more about Tolkien's Requiem, visit tolkiensrequiem.com. To learn more about Tolkien's Overture, visit tolkiensoverture.com. Or just go to tolkienroad.com/books to see them both at once. Seriously, though, I'm really proud of both of these books, and I know that you, like so many others, will enjoy them. So do yourself a favor and check them out. TolkienRoad.com/books. And now, back to the show.
Here ends the Silmarillion. If it has passed from the high and the beautiful to darkness and ruin, that was of old the fate of Arda marred. And if any change shall come and the marring be amended, Manwë and Varda may know. But they have not revealed it, and it is not declared in the dooms of Mondos. So, you know, and again, it's like this comes on the heels of the sinking of all of Beleriand under the oceans, right? So it's a pretty heavy ending, right? There's definitely some eucatastrophe. There's some good things, right? Morgoth is defeated, right? And he's shut beyond the walls of the world. We have the victory over these forces, but there's a lot of really sad things that happen as well throughout that story, and it never really it almost feels like it's kind of like, you know, this, if that's the ending, if that's all we have, then it's kind of like, well, I guess we just kind of have to be content with, you know, accepting all of the tragedy and just kind of moving on with the, you know, victories that don't seem as wonderful as we might hope, you know, in the end. I mean, it's pretty good to not have Morgoth anymore. I will say that, but
absolutely. It's somewhat of an agnostic ending. Manwë and Varda don't know how this is going to end. But when I read it, it feels like it's almost like a piece of music that doesn't resolve.
Oh yeah.
A little bit. And of course, given the fact that J.R.R. Tolkien didn't finish it and his son is having to construct the final couple of bars of the symphony, that could go a couple of different ways. And I think I understand why he chose this one. And it's not a completely Ragnarok type of ending, but it does end on that somewhat agnostic tone with even the Valar don't know.
Right. Well, tell us about this alternate ending. So kind of, can you spell out some of the details for, I guess the best way, the best summary of what to call it would be the second prophecy of Mondos. So, you know, kind of spell out what that is and where it comes from.
Well, the version I compared it to is the 1936 version of the Quintus Silmarillion, which is published in The Lost Road and other writings in the history of Middle Earth. And he has the paragraphs numbered in there, and I think it would be a little tedious to read all of it, but it's paragraphs 29 to 33 on pages 332 and 334 of The Lost Road. But the two paragraphs that I think are key, if it's not a problem to read these really quickly, number 31 and 32, thus spake Mandos in prophecy when the gods sat in judgment in Valinor, and the rumor of his words was whispered among all the elves of the West. When the world is old and the powers grow weary, then Morgoth, seeing that the guard sleepeth, shall come back through the door of night out of the timeless void, and he shall destroy the sun and moon. But Arendelle shall descend upon him as a white and searing flame and drive him from the airs. Then shall the last battle be gathered on the fields of Valinor. And that day Tolka shall strive with Morgoth, and on his right hand shall be Fionnwë, and on his left Turin Turambar, son of Hurin, coming from the halls of Mandos. And the black sword of Turin shall deal unto Morgoth his death and final end, and so shall the children of Hurin and all men be avenged. Thereafter shall earth be broken and remade, and the Silmaril shall be recovered out of air and earth and sea, for Arendelle shall descend and surrender that flame which he hath had in keeping. Then Feanor shall take the three jewels and bear them to Yavanna, Palurian, and she will break them and with their fire rekindle the two trees, and a great light shall come forth, and the mountains of Valinor shall be leveled, so that the light shall go out over all the world. In that light, the gods will grow young again, and the elves awake, and all their dead arise, and the purpose of Ilúvatar be fulfilled concerning them. But of men in that day, the prophecy of Mandos doth not speak, and no man it names save Turin only, and to him a place is given among the sons of the Valar. And then it has the here end at the Silmarillion, but it's still in that aerial frame from the early stories with the Mariner.
Right, applying the early frame narrative right to this, because this is 1936. This is before even The Hobbit is published that he brings. This is what he brought to the meeting with, the meeting with, who was it at the time? Was it Rainer Unwin? Or Stanley Unwin, I believe.
Milton Waldman.
I think the Waldman was later, because that was another publisher. But anyway, yes, this is what he was like, kind of. And I also have this, so maybe you can think about publishing this, the Silmarillion. And they're like, what is this? There's no hobbits here.
And that's an interesting side point. This was the Silmarillion he had in mind when he's writing The Hobbit.
Right.
And the Lord of the Rings, for that matter, because he doesn't return to it until afterwards.
And so this is the context of the writing of the Lord of the Rings, right? And of bringing that Hobbit, the idea of bringing the Hobbit's world together in a more direct and clear way with the world of the Silmarillion, which he achieved in the Lord of the Rings. I mean, this is a lot more exciting. This is a lot more of like a dun, 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 you know, like kind of ending to the Silmarillion. I mean, there's so much going on here. I made some notes on some of like the big things in this prophecy. In the end, Morgoth shall return and destroy the sun and moon. Arendelle shall descend and drive him from the airs. Then there'll be the last battle of Valinor. And you have Tolkis. And so it says Fionnwë, but and that's was he was later renamed Eonnwë. So that's the Herald of Manwë. And then Turin. So those three versus Morgoth in Valinor. And then Turin deals Morgoth the final death blow. And then after that, Earth shall be broken and remade. The Silmarils shall be recovered. Yavanna will rekindle the two trees. The mountains of Valinor shall be leveled so that their light fills the whole world. And the gods will grow young again, and the elves resurrected. And then there's that big note of like, but men are not spoken of, right? Nothing about men, though. Sorry, men. Yeah, so and that's an interesting question in of itself when we consider, and I think you actually get into that a little later in the article in hint as to why it might not be included right there with men. But it, like, there's just so much. This is such a like epic, eucatastrophic final end, you know, in all of this. And it's like, wow, why would Christopher choose to leave this out? I mean, you got Turin, you know, who's like the ultimate tragic figure in Tolkien's legendarium. And then you have a ultimately happy ending for him, or at least an ending where he avenges the death, right? Everything that Morgoth wrought upon him. Right. So yeah, I mean, I guess we have to ask ourselves, like, with all of the cool things going on here, the amazing things going on here, why would Christopher choose the other ending over this ending?
I think it boils down to something that his father wrote in 1958 in a 1958 manuscript of the Vala Quinta, and that's why I think that was on my mind earlier. Mm-hmm. The ending of that 1958 Vala Quinta manuscript is exactly the same as the ending of the published Silmarillion, with the one change being "here ends the Vala Quinta" is changed to "here ends the Silmarillion." But the key point is that in that 1958 manuscript, it reads, "If any change shall come and the marring be amended, Manwë and Varda may know, but they have not revealed it, and it is not declared in the dooms of Mandos." Well, in the 1936 ending, it is in the dooms of Mandos. It's his second prophecy. And so I think Christopher saw a conflict there. Well, is it revealed or isn't it? And mm-hmm. I think he says in one place that sometimes he dealt with these inconsistencies by simply eliminating one. And I think that's what he chose to do with this one, is he simplified it by eliminating one ending and choosing the 1958 Vala Quinta idea and ending the Silmarillion with that paragraph. Problem solved.
All right.
Apparently.
There may have been a little bit too of just like, I'm ready for this thing to be. You're a professor and a teacher, so I'm sure you know the student. I remember being a student in school and just being like, you've been working on this paper for a long time, and you're just like, I just want to be done, like, and it's due tomorrow. So I think I'm just going to round this off, you know, in kind of a short, you know, brief way. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that going on.
It may have been late at night that time. That day.
Right. So we see some, you know, some different reasons. You know, you mentioned this issue of the X in the margin with the War of the Jewels. Right. That there may have been, you know, maybe he was Xing this out, but maybe he wasn't. It was kind of ambiguous. And it may have, it could have been anything from like delete this part to delete certain parts to rework it, right? It's got to be, you know, it's just marking it for further work.
I do that all the time. I'll just put something in the margin just to remind myself of it. So there's any number of things that could be. But he seemed to take it, perhaps, you know, I think the Vala Quinta thing is a bigger reason, but it might have been that he thought that meant delete.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, there's certainly reasons why Christopher would have chosen the path that he chose. Another one that popped into my mind, and forgive me if you mentioned this, I didn't see it in the art. I don't recall seeing it in the article, but it might have just been a thought of like, well, I'm going to include, this isn't the end of this book, right? Of this publication, if you will, right? I'm going to go from here into Akalabeth, which is the second age. And I'm going to go from there into the third age, right? Of the Rings of Power in the third age. And so there may be a thought of like having this big, like, you know, eucatastrophic final end that goes all the way to, you know, the future and the end of the world, that maybe it just wasn't appropriate to put that right there. Right. You know, that could, it could be, you know, that kind of editorial decision, although I don't know that he claimed that, you know, anywhere. And then there's this issue of the, that you mentioned, of the lore of the Eldar, and which kind of gets into that whole question of, you know, frame narratives and, you know, how, like, Tolkien was insistent upon the like within the story, within the legendarium itself, of how we came to know certain things, right? That was almost as important to him as the stories themselves, right? Like that it was, he was consistent in terms of saying, like, we know this because this elf brought this lore to us, or we know what happens with men because the Numenoreans came up with this myth and these sorts of things. So, you know, they're all in all, there are reasons, right? There are reasons that Christopher may have chosen you know, it makes sense for him to have chosen this path. But, you know, let's kind of shift gears to your reasons that you mark out for retaining the second prophecy of Mondos, right? For actually viewing that as the appropriate ending to the Silmarillion, or as the more appropriate ending to the Silmarillion. I think these are really good arguments. So there's seven of them. And let's just go one by one through them and kind of explain your thought process there.
Absolutely. The first point I mentioned in the article was that the ending that contains and includes the second prophecy of Mandos is consistent with what Tolkien says in his essay on fairy stories. He makes this point, if somebody has the tree and leaf version of this, it's on page 68, where he writes, "The consolation of fairy stories has another aspect than the imaginative satisfaction of ancient desires. Far more important is the consolation of the happy ending. Almost, I would venture to assert that all complete fairy stories must have it. At least I would say that tragedy is the true form of drama, its highest function, but the opposite is true of fairy story. Since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, I will call it eucatastrophe. The eucatastrophic tale is the true form of fairy tale and its highest function." And I think that paragraph's important because, given that Tolkien devoted, you know, his entire adult life from World War I till his death in 1973 to constructing his own massive fairy tale, it seems odd that he would leave out, at least in my opinion, what all complete fairy stories must have. And yes, granted what you said, there is some of that with Morgoth being thrown into the void, but the prophecy of Mandos, it covers the whole gamut of that happy ending. It's like everything that we fell in love with at the beginning, the two trees and the Silmarils and all of that, this marred mess is finally going to be healed. So I think that, you know, the published ending leaves us with a little bit more of an agnostic what happened, and it doesn't have that, what I think Tolkien said was this must have for that kind of story. The second prophecy brings all of that into play in the conclusion that it entails.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happy ending, that your point of the happy ending there is huge. I mean, this is, and again, you know, this is what On Fairy Stories would have been composed around the same time that he's, you know, they were talking about the Quintus Silmarillion of 1936, right? So it was in within that same, you know, maybe give or take a few years, but it's within that same period of time that Tolkien is, I think, really, all of this is starting to come together in his mind, right? Like, he's got this Silmarillion thing, he's got the Hobbit thing that's starting to become the new Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And he's thinking about, like, the theory, like, deep down of all of this, like, what is this thing that seems to be his life's work? And it's all sort of starting to come together in his mind. And so, you know, he's insistent upon this in the essay, this happy ending, right? Of any good fairy story, any good fairy tale. And so it would make sense. And it was interesting. I think we were, we had a comment on one of our recent YouTube episodes posted on YouTube. And this individual was asking some really good questions about, like, the nature of, just like some sort of, they were asking as a non-Christian, non-religious person, like, they were asking some questions in the nature of, Like I thought this was supposed to be kind of a meditation, like kind of a sad story, right? It was sort of like like Eru just wanted to tell this like kind of melancholic, sad tale because of the beauty of the sadness and melancholy of it. And my response to that was like, well, yes, like the melancholy and the sadness is all very beautiful. It truly is. And tragic stories are beautiful in their own way. But ultimately, like that's not what the core of who Tolkien was, right? It's right there. And on Fairy Stories, right? The happy ending, right? That there is, even after all that tragedy, even after all that melancholy, that sadness, there's this joy that somehow emerges out of that. There's this hope, even amidst that, that was at the very core of what he was all about. And I think, you know, that this first point of the happy ending gets right to that, that ultimately the story of Middle Earth is not, it's got a lot of sadness. It's got a lot of tragedy in it, but it's not ultimately about that. It's about the ultimate hope, right? And, you know, that lies deep down.
And I think that we see, I mean, that's another later reason, but there's hints of that all over the place in Tolkien's writings, even if he doesn't call it the second prophecy. There's language about Arda healed in different phraseology.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes out in that second reason that I mentioned in another work he wrote, Words, Phrases, Passages in the Lord of the Rings. He talks about the reason for the creation of elves and men. And in this one section, he said, another purpose they, elves and men, had, which remained a mystery to the Valar, was to complete the design by, quote, he has little quotes on here, by healing the hurts which it suffered. And so ultimately not to recover Arda unmarred, that is the world as it would have been if evil had never appeared, but the far greater thing, Arda healed. Mm-hmm. And he's writing this in the latter half of the 1950s and perhaps the early 60s. Christopher's not entirely sure, but it's still pointing to something on the other side of Arda marred, the mess that Melkor made and Morgoth made. So even in the late 50s or early 60s, he still has this idea of Arda healed as being part of the purpose of elves and men. And that tells me that at that point in his life, he had not rejected the idea of that ultimate happy ending of Arda healed.
That goes back to 1936, right? Yeah. Well before Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
So at least from the World War I up to the late 50s, early 60s, I see that theme remaining constant and lining up with his theory of fairy stories in his essay.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also consistent with what he wrote in that letter to Milton Waldman in 1951, letter 131. He's giving a brief sketch of the legends, and he says, this legendarium ends with a vision of the end of the world, of its breaking and remaking, and the recovery of the Silmarils and the light before the sun after a final battle, which owes, I suppose, more to the Norse vision of Ragnarok than to anything else, though it is not much like it. But he mentions those aspects that you listed from the second prophecy of Mandos, the end of the world, breaking, remaking, recovering the Silmarils, a final battle. And that is the second prophecy of Mandos. That's the only thing that vision that he mentions could be referring to it. And what's the most fascinating is that in a later edition of the published Silmarillion, Christopher includes that letter as the preface to the book. So in a weird way, the published version of the Silmarillion includes the second prophecy of Mandos, but doesn't include it because it's there in the preface in the letter, but it's not in the ending of the Quinta.
I just have to like pause on that point and just say again, like I have so much love and thankfulness for Christopher and just the incredible like devotion he had to his father's work, to just make that his life's work, to just put all this stuff out there. And the way that he did it too, it's not without its issues, but ultimately I think it was the best way to do it because it provided it. He just laid it all out there. He said, here's everything in the best way I can give it to you that my father wrote, all of the different variations of these things. And now, you know, and I think of this in terms of like, we're on the precipice of all of these stories becoming known to everyone because of Lord of the Rings on Prime and, you know, and Amazon putting hundreds of millions of dollars into these stories. But now we have what, you know, we can make good arguments about what Tolkien himself actually invented. Now I hope that intended. And I hope that people of Amazon take that to heart and do their research. Who knows if they do? I'll try to be optimistic about it, but you know, at the end of the day, like I just love that Christopher, that he went back and he added on like this Waldman letter, you know, from 1951 for another edition of the Silmarillion at the beginning. And almost just to say like, here's a good take from my father on like what the story of the whole thing actually is. So
that's this fantastic letter.
It is. It's so good. It's what we did our very first episode on with the podcast. We started there because we went through the whole Silmarillion chapter by chapter. And I was just like, this letter is so good. We need to start here because it kind of breaks everything down, you know, for you when it comes to the Silmarillion.
And when I have students who are getting lost in the Silmarillion, go read the letter. That's it's a nice, concise Reader's Digest version of that whole thing. So it's brilliant.
Absolutely.
A couple of other points I made was the ending of the second prophecy is consistent with things that are said elsewhere in the published Silmarillion. For example, in the Ainur Lindale, Morgoth's attempts to create discord, we're told Ilúvatar will not let that ultimately win. And thou, Melkor, shall see that no theme may be played that hath not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempteth this shall prove but mine instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined. It doesn't mention specifically the second prophecy of Mandos, but it's saying Morgoth is not going to win ultimately in any way, shape, or form, that anything he tries to use for evil, Ilúvatar is going to turn it for good. And I think with the second prophecy, that comment and the second prophecy, here's how he did it, you know, and it frames that whole thing. It seems to me that the second prophecy ending is also consistent with revisions that Tolkien was making to the Silmarillion in the later part of his life. There's evidence, I think, positive evidence that he intended to keep the second prophecy. Christopher, I have to refer to two separate books in the history of Middle Earth, so this gets a little bit complicated, but in The Lost Road, he was making some comments about new subheadings his father was adding. And then later in The War of the Jewels, he notes that when he first commented on these new subheadings, he says, quote, I neglected, however, to mention there the introduction of a further subheading, the second prophecy of Mandos, at paragraph 31. And he says that in War of the Jewels on page 247, which to me means that even at this late stage in the revisions, the massive revisions Tolkien was doing to the Silmarillion, if he had a subheading called The Second Prophecy of Mandos, it tells me that he was intending to include that, even if he was going to reframe it, rework it, reword it. Why else would you include the subheading if you're not going to include the content of the prophecy? And then even more importantly, I think, in the later Quintus Silmarillion, Tolkien has a section where Manwë explicitly speaks of Arda healed. After discussing the nature of death, he makes this point. This is in the book Morgoth's Ring on page 245. Manwë says, for Arda unmarred hath two aspects or senses. The first is the unmarred that they discern in the marred, if their eyes are not dimmed, and yearn for, as we yearn for, the will of Eru. This is the ground upon which hope is built. The second is the unmarred, that shall be, that is to speak according to time in which they have their being, the Arda healed, which shall be greater and more fair than the first because of the marring. This is the hope that sustaineth. It cometh not only from the yearning for the will of Ilúvatar the Begetter, which by itself may lead those within time to no more than regret, but also from trust in Eru, the Lord Everlasting, that he is good, and that his work shall all end in good. This, the marrer, the Morgoth, hath denied, and in this denial is the root of evil, and its end is despair. Here you have Manwë explicitly speaking of Arda healed in these revisions to the Silmarillion, and it seems to be, to me again, to be consistent with an ending that includes that second prophecy than with the published ending that says, if any change shall come, Manwë and Varda may know, but they haven't revealed it. In this revision, this later revision, Manwë does reveal it.
Right.
So
yeah, and just so everybody kind of has that framework in their mind, when Keith talks about this being a later revision, we're talking about here Morgoth's Ring, which was volume 10 of the History of Middle Earth, right? And these are writings that are from the 50s and in some cases the 60s that come after Lord of the Rings, right? So these are all late, much later writings, right? And you mentioned earlier passages from the War of the Jewels. That's actually even later. That's volume 11, right? So these are not things that were early on. These are things that are later on, right? These are things that reflect what Tolkien, when he was really giving himself to, okay, how do I want to present the Silmarillion to the world after all of his life's work had gone into this? This is where he landed with these things, right? He was still working on these things. So, I mean, pretty strong positive evidence here.
I think so. If he's still including this prophecy in the 50s and 60s, then I would need stronger evidence than an X. And and I do think the ending that to the Vala Quinta that Tolkien wrote in 1958 is a strong argument, but I do think there's a reason for that, which we can talk about in a minute if you'd like. But and then the last couple of things I mentioned were, well, the sixth argument was that it's the second prophecy ending is consistent with what is said by characters in the Lord of the Rings book. Tom Bombadil, when he drives the barrel wide away, he ends his song with a reference to a future time when, quote, the world is mended. And when Galadriel says goodbye to Treebeard, she says they will not meet again in Middle Earth, quote, nor until the lands that lie under the wave are lifted up again, end quote. Mm-hmm. And that's a little more vague, but it seems to be referring to the healing of Arda at some point in the future when the earth is remade.
It's hard to imagine what else it might refer to. I mean, you know, it certainly sounds like a eucatastrophic, you know, very, very beautiful, hopeful thing that won't happen until sometime in the far distant future, right?
It's a reversal of what happened to the Numenoreans. It's raised up out of the water again.
Right.
The last thing I mentioned is that the ending with the second prophecy, I think, is consistent with this work called the Author Beth Finrod Andreth, which is an interesting discussion all by itself.
Oh, the Author Beth is fascinating, yes.
It is mind-bogglingly fascinating. But the prophecy says, the second prophecy says, but of men in that day the prophecy of Mandos doth not speak, and no man it names save Turin only, and to him a place is given among the sons of Valar. The Author Beth is this record of a dialogue between this elf lord and this human woman that includes, among many other topics, speculation on the ultimate fate of men, which the second prophecy says, even in the 36th version, it doesn't talk about. Mm-hmm. And as such, it would fill in that gap potentially had it been included in the work. The 36 ending with the second prophecy, we have nothing about men. The Author Beth, here's some speculation about the ending for men. And in my opinion, it seems to me that Tolkien clearly wanted the Author Beth to be included as an appendix to the Silmarillion. Christopher himself notes that the manuscript of the Author Beth was wrapped in a newspaper, and he says that on the wrapping, his father wrote the words, quote, should be the last item in an appendix, end quote. Wow. And Christopher himself says what his father meant was an appendix to the Silmarillion. So that again is in Morgoth's Ring, page 329, but that wasn't included. And I think that's a different discussion why, but it's, had it been included, I think not only would it include a fascinating perspective on the end for men, but could possibly provide the solution to the conflict that Christopher saw, because in Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien's commentary on the Author Beth, he says, and here again, this is Morgoth's Ring, page 342, it is noteworthy that the elves have no myths or legends dealing with the end of the world. The myth that appears at the end of the Silmarillion is of Numenorean origin. It is clearly made by men, though men acquainted with elvish tradition. The myth that appears at the end of Silmarillion, that has to be, again, the second prophecy of Mandos. There's no other myth at the end of any version. Mm-hmm. But here, what he says here about elvish myths and Numenorean myths, I think would have provided Christopher an out on this. There's no, when you're dealing with this collection of mythologies of elvish origin and Numenorean origin, I don't think there's any requirement that they would all fit and be perfectly consistent. That's not true of ancient Roman legends or Greek or Norse legends. There's always inconsistencies in those things. So the Numenoreans have a legend and the elves have a legend. That wouldn't trouble me. I don't know if it would trouble other readers, but it might have troubled J.R.R. Tolkien because he was always striving for some consistency. But given what he says about Numenorean myths, I mean, he says the myth that appears at the end of Silmarillion is Numenorean, and it mm-hmm. includes the end of the world. But elves have no myths about the end of the world. And that's J.R.R.'s words there. So it seems to me that in the notes to the author, Beth, that could be potentially a consistent solution to the really big problem that Christopher found. And it was a legitimate issue, but it seems to me that his father might have provided a simple answer to it.
Right. Yeah. And again, we come back to the thing with Christopher of, you know, the work that went into producing just the Silmarillion itself by 1977 mm-hmm. had to have been monumental. And he, even beyond that, he was still discovering things that his father had written after that was published. Right. And it's this whole epic journey for him throughout the rest of his life, to put together that whole Unfinished Tales and then the History of Middle-earth so that we'd have all the rest of these writings and kind of just lay it all out for us to have as a legacy, right?
I think it would have been fascinating what would have happened if he had taken, I mean, his father dies in 1973, he begins work and publishes the Silmarillion only 4 years later, which means it went to the publisher at the latest in 1976, so maybe 3 years. What if he had spent 10 years or 15 in working on the Silmarillion? Would it have looked the same had he had the time to go through all of the things that he publishes in the History of the Middle Earth? I mean, that's, we don't know. We can never know what he would have done, but I wonder sometimes if it would have looked the same.
Oh, that was kind of the spirit behind my, this video, the video I made that you responded to and got this dialogue going with us. Right. I was like, there's, as much as I love the Silmarillion, there's problems with it, not in terms of, maybe now we say with maybe a little bit with the story, but in terms of the ending, but I don't have like gripes with it. I'm just like, it could have been presented, I feel like, in a better way. Like there's ways to connect it to, I am a big advocate for the idea of incorporating a frame narrative into all of it. Right. And with familiar characters that allow us to relate to these stories as they would relate to them, so that we can both feel like, okay, we know some characters and now we're hearing about these ancient stories that matter to them. Right. And they're the history of this world, doing more maps, and more, just more appendices of helpful material, timelines and that sort of thing. It all makes me think like maybe like has me kind of praying, begging, like maybe one of these days we can get like the director's cut of the Silmarillion or something like that, right?
Third edition.
Right. Or just like vastly expanded with a really great, by a really great editor who can go back and is very knowledgeable of the history of Middle Earth and can synthesize maybe we say this is Christopher's Silmarillion, right? And then we go back and say, here's another take on the Silmarillion, all based on Tolkien's actual writings, not this editor making stuff up, but based on Tolkien's actual writings. It feels like we have enough with the history of Middle Earth to maybe make that happen, but who knows if that'll ever happen.
With Christopher's death, you wonder if anybody could ever be trusted with that.
I know.
Committee of Tolkien Society or something, but he went back and rewrote an entire chapter of The Hobbit to make it fit better. So I would be perfectly content. I mean, I'm content with the Silmarillion as it is. At least the 36 ending is out there for people who want to read it. But I would love it if they would include that maybe just in a footnote, small print footnote. Here's an alternate ending. Obviously, I wouldn't have written this thing if it wasn't my preference if they would do a third edition and add that back. But I don't, realistically, I don't have hopes of that happening in my lifetime. So.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe you never know. The Lord of the Rings on Prime thing was a complete shock. Came out of left field when they announced that several years ago. So, I mean, who knows? There's absolutely a lot of money to be made from Tolkien forever. So, you know, it just, I guess, kind of depends on those sorts of questions, maybe in this cynical age in which we live.
It's hard to imagine. I mean, I'm appealing to Priscilla Tolkien in her old age. Hey, take a second look at it. But after this long, what's it been, 45, 50 years, people have... That's the Silmarillion.
It is
in people's minds. So
it is.
It would be very, very difficult to convince a lot of people of that. And again, I wrote this not thinking there's any realistic shot anybody would do this, but because Christopher invited criticism, and I would have, after going through the history of Middle Earth, almost all of it, I wouldn't have written this had he not himself invited that kind of criticism, because I stand in awe of what he did. Looking at the history of Middle Earth, my jaw is on the floor after reading that one man, I mean, it's amazing that his father, one man, created a mythology that most other cultures, it takes centuries and hundreds of people to build. He did it by himself. And then the work his son did is equally impressive. Spent his whole life trying to sort through all these manuscripts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I did want to come back. So you mentioned, and I forget the context, but you mentioned wanted to come back to a point about the Valaquenta, the later Valaquenta. Do you recall what that point was?
I think I mentioned the point that the later, the Valaquenta, the 1958 ending that he used for the ending of the Silmarillion could be attributed to the Elvish legends, whereas the 1936 ending of the Silmarillion could be a Numenorean legend.
Got it. Okay.
And that might solve the problem. And that was suggested by J.R.R.'s notes to the author, Beth.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. This has been very, you know, this has been a great discussion, like very educational. I mean, this is a great article. Y'all definitely, as you're listening to this episode, I'm saying this at the end now, of course. So, you know, but I'm going to make sure we have, you know, this is linked to in the show notes and everything like that. So even if you're at the end of this episode, you need to go read the article on Keith's blog and just, you know, go through, because he's got all the quotations, Gary, there. He's got all the citations and everything, so you can see these things for yourself. I think the case is strong. If I could go back to the mid 70s and advise Christopher, I would say put this one in there. It's so much better, right? Or maybe put it at the very end of the Silmarillion, like after of the Rings of Power in the Third Age, with some, you know, maybe a couple of pages, just as kind of a, you know, as a finale or something like that to the whole work.
One of the appendices to the Lord of the Rings.
Right. You know, however you might do it, but. I think this is just a fascinating exploration nevertheless. And I really appreciate your putting it together and coming on the show and talking about it with us, Keith.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate the invitation and enjoyed it.
All right. Fantastic. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Andrew T, John R, Ms. Anonymous, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Shannon S, Brian O, Emilio P, Zeke F, James A, James L, Chris L, Chuck F, Azia V, Ish of the Hammer, Teresa C, David of Pints with Jack, Jonathan D, Eric S, Eric B, Johanna T, Mike M, Robert H, Paul D, Julia, and Werty, as well as those celebrating their Patreon anniversary in October, Heathen Rohirrim and Adam. All right. Keith, once again, thank you. And thanks to all of our listeners. We will talk at you next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.